Franklin Delano Roosevelt, President and Commander-in-Chief of United States Armed Forces during World War II, did not live to celebrate the triumph of this nation and its allies. To ensure a future with perpetual peace on Earth, he had guided the United States and its allied nations through the preliminary steps in the establishment of the United Nations. He had appointed Ralph Bunche to assist in laying the groundwork for this organization designed to maintain peace and stability and transform a disturbed world to one in which tranquility and brotherhood were universal. Less than a month before the end of the war in Europe, the president suffered a stroke on April 12th and died. The reins of government passed suddenly and unexpectedly into the hands of the vice president, and Harry S. Truman became president of the United States. It became his task to lead the nation to final victory in Europe and in the Pacific, and to guide the transition from war to peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, Harry S. Truman, president of the United States.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
By 1945, there were two black representatives in the United States Congress, William L. Dawson, who won Arthur Mitchell's seat after he retired, and Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. Dawson was considered the dean of America's black congressional delegation. 2 years later, the young New York City councilman and minister of Harlem's Abyssinian Baptist Church, Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., won a seat in Congress from his Harlem district. Almost immediately upon taking his seat in the House of Representatives, Powell began to campaign loudly for the extension of equal civil rights to the nation's black citizens. He protested the segregationist policies prevalent in the nation's capital. His debates with arch segregationist congressmen from the South brought him headlines.
What's your outlook for the FEPC bill?
Excellent. We have come to a meeting of the minds, and the staff minority and majority now working up the final print, and Wednesday after the 4th of July weekend, that bill will be reported out with bipartisan support from my committee, and I'm sure that on the floor it'll be passed overwhelmingly.
Among the delegates to the first meeting of the United Nations held in San Francisco in October 1945 was the black American statesman Ralph Bunche. President Truman also appointed several observers to this initial meeting: William E. B. Du Bois, Mary McLeod Bethune, Mordecai Johnson, and Walter White. These blacks helped mold the organization designed to maintain peace in the world. President Truman appointed a committee on civil rights in 1946 to study the plight of minorities throughout the nation. The following year, this committee, which included among its members Mrs. Sadie T. Alexander and Dr. Channing Tobias, issued a report titled To Secure These Rights. The goals outlined in the report were adopted officially by the Truman administration as national goals and as national policy by both the Democrats and Republicans at their national conventions. Although some blacks were hired in a few formerly all-white jobs, for the masses of black citizens, discrimination was still a fact of life. In 1946, black athletes began to integrate professional football. Kenny Washington and Woody Strode were signed by the Los Angeles Rams. The Cleveland Browns signed Bill Willis and Marion Motley. Motley gained fame as one of pro football's greatest fullbacks. The same year, Jackie Robinson, shortstop with the black Kansas City Monarchs, was signed to the Brooklyn Dodgers, becoming the first black to play Major League Baseball in the modern era. Robinson won Rookie of the Year honors in 1947, Most Valuable Player Award in 1949, played on several National League All-Star teams, electrifying the fans with his hitting and base stealing.
Basically, I think it opened the way for other people to see that it works in baseball, where the competition is so keen and the associations are so close, that it opened the way in other bits of industry. So this, to me, is the biggest contribution the acceptance of the Negro in baseball made, opening the way for young people, inspiring them to do a better job and preparing themselves for the opening that would present itself.
In 1948, President Truman issued Executive Order 9981, integrating the armed forces of the United States. Many commanders resisted this order, and several years were to pass before the armed services could be considered truly integrated. But with millions of black and white youths serving side by side in all military units, whites returning to civilian life began to challenge the discriminatory traditions of their forefathers. To many white supremacists, the idea of blacks demanding equal treatment was enraging. Lynchings continued to be a way of life in the South. It was not until 1952 that a whole year had passed without one lynching anywhere in the United States. The United Nations was facing its first task as a peacekeeping organization. In the Middle East, the infant nation of Israel was engaged in battle with its Arab neighbors. A UN mediation team headed by Sweden's Count Bernadotte, tried to arrange a truce. In 1948, Count Bernadotte was assassinated, and his assistant, Ralph Bunche, took over as chief mediator. Dr. Bunche was soon successful in establishing peace in the area, and in recognition of his tremendous efforts, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1950, thus becoming the first black American to receive this award.
I am deeply honored by this award. But my happiness is in no way a factor in causing me to forget that whatever I was able to do in Palestine was a result of the fact that I was backed by the great international peace organization, the United Nations.
In our nation's capital in 1949, Congressman William Dawson became chairman of the House Committee on Government Operations, the first time a black had ever chaired a congressional committee. A year later, another first was scored as Gwendolyn Brooks became the first black poet to win the coveted Pulitzer Prize. One of the most vital contributions to the field of medical science was achieved by Dr. Charles Drew. Dr. Drew developed the concept of blood banks and did extensive research into the separation and storage of blood. His blood banks have eliminated most of the uncertainties and dangers of direct blood transfusions. Dr. Drew was made director of the American Red Cross Blood Donor Project and set up its blood bank system. It was the policy of the Red Cross not to accept blood from any black donors. After several years of urging and criticism from Dr. Drew and others, the Red Cross and other United States blood banks recognized the scientific fact that there were no racial differences in blood and integrated the blood banks. Also in 1950, the New York Philharmonic presented the world premiere of Howard Swanson's Short Symphony, commissioned by Dimitri Mitropoulos. Swanson, acknowledged dean of black American composers, had studied intensively in the United States and Europe under several grants. His Short Symphony, in competition with major works of international composers, won the coveted New York Music Critics Award as the best orchestral work of 1950. Other prominent black composers of the period were William Grant Still, whose Afro-American symphony was recorded by Stokowski and the prolific Ulysses Kay. A decade earlier, another black, Dean Dixon, became not only the first black, but also the youngest person to ever conduct the New York Philharmonic. Dixon was only 26 years old when he took the podium and directed this great orchestra through its program. The demand for black singers and entertainers in the movie industry was increasing. such people as Jimmy Rushing, one of the greatest blues singers, with the Count Basie Orchestra.
Mama, don't you beg your daddy.
Miller and Lyles, Williams and Walker, Burt Williams, Willie Best, Step and Fetch It, Mantan Moore, and Ethel Waters, Frederick O'Neill, Canada Lee, Frank Silvera, Rex Ingram, had set a precedent. Some of the names that followed include Sammy Davis Jr., Ossie Davis, Sidney Poitier, Raymond C. Jacques, Dorothy Dandridge, Max Roach, William Marshall, James Earl Jones, Pearl Bailey, Leslie Uggams, Red Fox, Pygmy Markham, and Moms Mabley.
Well, as I live and breathe, look who's here. I hear somebody I really didn't expect to meet. Pearl, what you doing down here on Rampart Street?
Well, Jackie, I am down here to try to have me a ball at one of these sad fish
What's
rides.
What's sad?
Ain't you ever been in New Orleans? Yeah? Well, you can understand what I mean. All through the week is quiet as a mouse, but on Saturday night they go from house to house and they're rocking.
You mean they're rocking?
I'm telling you, they're rocking.
No kidding.
You never seen such scuffing in the shuffle until the break of dawn.
In June of 1950, fighting broke out between North and South Korean troops. Quickly, President Truman committed American troops to assist the South Koreans. Once again, the United States was involved in a war on foreign soil. It was clear that World War II had not been, as many hoped, the war to end all wars. Despite national dismay at being embroiled in another war, the Korean conflict hastened the complete integration of the armed forces. PFC William Thompson became the first black soldier since the Spanish-American War to win the Congressional Medal of Honor in 1951. Soon after, another black soldier, Sergeant Cornelius Charlton, won this same honor while losing his life.
In distinguishing himself by conspicuous and gallantry and intrepidity above and beyond the call of duty in action against the enemy,
The nation, however, looking about for someone who could end the Korean War, turned to the popular war hero, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Running for president on the Republican ticket, General Eisenhower won an overwhelming victory over his Democratic opponent, Adlai Stevenson, and in 1953 was inaugurated as president. While ending the war was not an immediate achievement, President Eisenhower was successful in another unexpected field. Soon after taking office, he announced that he would visit no facility open to the public in Washington, D.C., which discriminated against blacks. As a result of this announcement, theaters, restaurants, hotels, and auditoriums in the nation's capital were forced to accept non-discriminatory policies. The same year in New York City, Hewlin Jack was elected borough president of Manhattan and became the only black elected executive in a racially mixed city in the United States.
It proved that a black man could be elected to a high office. I want to say that the strength of any minority rests in its voting power.
A problem that spanned the end of the Truman administration and the first years of the Eisenhower administration was a charade presented by Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. McCarthy made blanket accusations of communist infiltration of key government positions. He embarked on a sensational witch hunt, looking for communists everywhere. Although he was able to prove the truth of only a very few of his accusations, the fact that he made them with such assurance was enough to jeopardize the careers of many loyal Americans. Not content to find communists in the government, McCarthy ranged far afield into the business, literary, and entertainment fields. Among those whose reputations were damaged by McCarthyism was black singer-actor Paul Robeson. During the Depression years, many other Americans had investigated communism, as had author Richard Wright. Eventually, his colleagues in the Senate tired of his bombastic displays, and McCarthy was censured by them in 1954. President Eisenhower appointed J. Ernest Wilkins to Assistant Secretary of Labor. In this position, Secretary Wilkins led the American delegation to the General Conference of the International Labor Organization in Geneva, Switzerland. Wilkins also was the first black to preside over a meeting of the president's cabinet.
I feel that this position gives me an opportunity to demonstrate to all the peoples of the world how Americans feel about all of its citizens.
In May of 1954, the Supreme Court delivered an opinion that completely demolished the separate but equal practices in effect since 1896. In the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the Supreme Court held that separate facilities were inherently unequal, and later ordered desegregation of schools with all deliberate speed. It was only a matter of time before all legal barriers to integration would be removed. However, Southern resistance to integration remained firm. Senator Maybank of South Carolina announced,
"Our custom of segregation has proved mutually satisfactory to the vast majority of both races in South Carolina. In my opinion, these agitators are making a serious mistake when during the stress of war, they seek by law to abrogate customs which are as old and deep-rooted in the South as our civilization itself. Mr. President, the white people of the South will not accept these interferences."
This defiance to the Supreme Court's decision was emphasized on the local level. A Virginia county, whose school board was implicated in the decision, closed all of its public schools rather than integrate. And in 1956, after Authorine Lucy had obtained a federal court order directing the administration of the University of Alabama to admit her as a student, a white mob gathered at the university. Miss Lucy was never admitted, nor was any black, until 1963, when two black students finally began to attend the University of Alabama. A year after Miss Lucy's failure to gain admission to the Alabama school, the Little Rock, Arkansas School Board had an integration plan approved by the Federal District Court and moved to implement it, beginning with the city's Central High School. Nine black children were to be admitted to classes. In a repetition of events at Alabama, a vicious mob of whites surrounded the high school and subjected these frightened black children with insults, threats, and physical attacks. Arkansas's Governor Orville Faubus called out the state's National Guard to preserve the peace. They did not restrain the mob, however. As tension mounted, President Eisenhower issued a proclamation urging obedience to the law. This was ignored, and the president quickly issued an executive order, number 10730.
"I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law at Little Rock, Arkansas. This became necessary when my proclamation of yesterday was not observed, and the obstruction of justice still continues."
For the first time since Reconstruction, an American president had ordered troops into a state to enforce and protect the rights of black citizens. United States paratroopers escorted the black students through the angry mob into the schoolhouse. In 1958, all of Little Rock's high schools were closed, but they opened again in 1959 on an integrated basis. The administrations of Presidents Roosevelt, Truman, and Eisenhower had tried repeatedly to get civil rights legislation through Congress. Although several bills had been passed by the House of Representatives, they all failed to survive the filibusters mounted by Southern senators. Finally, in 1957, in the shadow of Little Rock, President Eisenhower managed to garner enough support in the Senate to defeat the filibuster. The first civil rights bill of the 20th century was passed into law. The Civil Rights Act of 1957, the enforcement provisions of this act were admittedly weak, and the design of a stronger law was begun almost immediately. 3 years later, in Eisenhower's final year in office, the Civil Rights Act of 1960 was pushed through Congress. Ever since the Reconstruction period, blacks in the United States Diplomatic Corps have been assigned to posts only in countries governed by black governments. In 1958, President Eisenhower departed from this tradition by appointing black diplomat Clifton R. Wharton to the post of ambassador to Romania. A succession of Supreme Court decisions favorable to minority groups and the example of African and Asian nations gaining their independence inspired the American minorities to more vigorous efforts to gain their rights. While this new trend toward self-determination was taking place, a presidential election was fast approaching. The young, handsome, and dynamic John F. Kennedy seemed to be the ideal man to lead the United States through the soaring 60s.